Welcome to Funds That Won, where we dive into some of the world's most renowned investment funds. We'll interview investment managers across the alternative landscape and learn how they built their million and even billion dollar asset management empires. We'll explore teams, structures, strategies, and best practices in launching and running alternative investment funds. Hey, what's up, guys? So a couple weeks ago, as you might know, we had Fund Launch Live, and I was able to moderate this fantastic panel on the future of technology in alternative assets with Andrew Smith, Kaloa Wolfgram, Bryce Sutton, and Dan Young. I've had several of them on the podcast, before, but collectively these guys manage, I think, north of about $3 billion in assets. And, at the end, they give some advice to emerging fund managers. I just thought it was a great panel. So we wanted to throw that in for today's episode. Hope you guys enjoy. Thanks.
All right. We have a fantastic panel here today. Thank you all for coming. Let's start with some really brief introductions on each of you. Please include like what type of fund you're running, assets under management, just 30-second bio. Let's start with Kaloa. Oh, he never got a mic. We'll start with Andrew. We'll work our way around.
Is this working?
Now it works.
We can turn on all the handheld mics on. That'd be great. Thanks. Go ahead.
Does that work? You guys hear it? All right. Andrew Smith. I'm the GP of a fund called Savory Fund. We invest into food and beverage, restaurants, and restaurant tech. Kicked it off about 7 years ago, a little over $750 million AUM, 12 brands across the United States, part of a larger fund called Mercado Partners. 2.2 billion AUM, invest into SaaS, VC as well. So it's a very multifaceted strategy, Mercado Partners, but I'm the GP of Savory Fund.
Fantastic. Bryce?
Yeah, good morning. I'm Bryce Sutton with Summit Global Investments. I'm a co-founder and a managing partner of the firm. We run 9 different funds. Most of them are public funds, so think of ETFs and mutual funds. We also run our own private hedge fund, where we do a lot of, we'll call it global macro, more options-based derivatives investing for our LPs in that fund. And we manage a little over $2 billion.
Dan Young, founded Zydex and PC Laptops back in 92. And Bridger Pennington is my partner. We're 50-50 on the Ugly Unicorn Crypto Hedge Fund. We started in 2022. Bitcoin dropped within 90 days, 77%. We corrected only 17%, and we made our investors 63.7% net, even with the bear market last year.
So fantastic. Kaloa, will you pass mic? Thanks.
Yeah, Kaloa Wolfgram, founded a tech startup a couple years ago, sold it, and currently run a hospitality fund. We're $600 million in assets under management.
Fantastic. All right, let's get into it. So this panel is going to be talking about the future of technology and alternatives. First, I just want to talk about like the transformation we're seeing in the alternative asset marketplace. To cue it up, just a statistic here for you guys. In 1950, 6.5 million Americans owned U.S. stock. By 1990, 51 million Americans owned U.S. stock. And today, over 158 million Americans owned U.S. stock. So we've seen this mass adoption into traditional investments like the stock market. Are we going to see the same in alternatives? Why or why not? Let's start with Andrew.
I think we're already starting to see it. I think that there's a lot of investors that not only do we meet with, but they look at their stock portfolio and they say, I'm heavy in the stock and I have personal assets, but I'm not in alts. And they don't really understand alts. They don't even know how to approach it. So I think that over the years that I've pitched hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of potential LPs, most of them are, well, I want some exposure to this, but I just don't know how. And I think that now, as I look forward into the future, more people are looking at it as a class that they have to balance out their portfolio. When you look at an individual LP, a high net worth individual, they're looking at allocating, 5 to 15% of their net worth into alts. When before, I don't think that that's how it was even close to. I think that high net worth family offices, they're looking more at like 25 to 35% of their office into alts. And then you look at some of the wealth management firms, they're still at 5 and 6% allocation into alts, but they're wanting to get into that 15, 20%. So they're just looking for opportunity. And I think that there's a lot of opportunity to pitch those types of firms, and he could probably mention how they look at it as well.
Bryce, please.
Yeah, it's interesting. As Lincoln was saying, it's easy to own stocks. It's easy to open an account with on your Webull or Robinhood or Schwab. What's hard is for investors, limited partners that want to own this, to actually get into that asset class. They don't have the education that they need to understand how to do that. And so it's important as fund managers to educate the investors on, here's the process of how that works. And so we're seeing quite a flow from the public markets into the private markets within our own firm because of A, the diversification it brings, and we need better options personally and individually to, you know, kind of spread that risk around. So we're seeing a much greater adoption. Some of our clients are up to 40% alts in their portfolios.
I think you're going to see this same thing. You guys know the Bitcoin halving is happening in what, about 10 hours? Anybody excited about that? Yeah? We're super excited about that. And so when he asked about alts, Bridger actually handles all of our fund structure and compliance. I manage the money. But I think when you talked about the adoption, the people invest in stocks on a large level, I think you're going to see the same thing into blockchain. We're a little bit older here. We were just talking about it. It feels like we're almost in the mid-90s to early 2000s with blockchain. So I think you're going to see that ease of adoption come into play here in the next little bit.
Maybe the only thing I'd add is it's interesting how a traditional concept of what an alt was, I think, is slowly starting to change a little bit with the rise of the retail investor being a little more savvy toward alt and it being more applicable and open for investors. Originally, it was like stocks, bonds, cash, right? And nowadays, every person is making over 200, 250K a year. They're already starting to invest into like real estate in particular. And so it's interesting where at one point, real estate syndication or investments or into a real estate fund was, you know, something that was reserved for the ultra wealthy. We are starting to see, at least on our side, a lot more of that become more retail based. So I think alts is kind of the definition of what alts is starting to change a little bit, maybe over the last even 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, as a quick follow-up, you know, as fund managers, is it worth working with the retail investor? Or would you just prefer to stick with bigger checks? I mean, just anyone want to chime in on that?
When we first started our firm back in 2010, we immediately went after institutions because that was our backgrounds. And we immediately found that we didn't have a 3-year track record, a 5-year track record, a 10-year track record that they were looking for. And it became much easier to have the meetings with individuals, call it retail, higher net worth, that could actually make those initial checks happen. And then, thankfully, over the years, you build those institutional type relationships up. And you know, now we're the largest equity manager for the University of North Carolina Management Company, which is all the schools in North Carolina, the universities and colleges. So it takes time to build those relationships. They just don't happen overnight.
Yeah, I'm going to add to that. I'm going to say that the bigger check writer is usually a pain in the ass. So everybody should know it's really fun to go whale hunting and spear a whale, right? But at the end of the day, they can be tough. And like he said, they're long. They take a long time to get landed. And once you land them, there's also a lot higher requirement to make sure that they maintain a positive attitude about the fund. So I would say balancing it out. We always talk about it, putting in the boulders in the bin and then try to fill it in with sand. I think the sand is a lot more fun because it's a lot more people like us that are investing. But the larger check writers, it's easier once you have them. Like you said, once you get one and you get a retirement system or a pension or an endowment, it's great because you raise another fund and then they're going to recommit another $20, $30, $40 million if you're performing. Performance is key, right? But at the end of the day, the retail consumer out there that is looking for a new fund manager, they're wanting to be involved and they're excited to be involved. Those are the ones you should probably hunt, especially if you're a new emerging manager. I would really target retail because endowments, pensions, they're going to want to see your success for 5-10 years, and I'm just barely getting them to look at us at 7 years.
Two quick comments that we've noticed. One is it also depends on the timing of when you're raising. If you can land an institutional early as your first investor or anchor investor, maybe you have to give up some GP stakes or other things. Like the rest of the retail is a little bit easier because you have that signal to the market. So you land a Sorensen or a Peak or a Bridge, you know, these kind of groups, the retail investors can come a little bit easier. The other thing that we've noticed is retail investors have kind of a longer sales cycle up front, but then their follow-on investments typically are a little bit easier, just that we've noticed. So you might have to do some educating, you might have to, you know, really work through all their CPA and all the stuff and kind of educate them to get their first check in. But we found after they invested us one time, their second, third, fourth, fifth investments, like frankly, I don't know if they were reading our docs. They were just signing in and sending them in. Whereas institutions, we've noticed, I mean, they're doing the full DD, every single check. I mean, it's a little bit more, even for the follow-ons.
Yeah. To add on, to continue the conversation, I guess, you know, what changes can we expect in the alternatives landscape over the coming decade? What are you seeing right now? What's changing about your process? What's changing about your investor base, your access? Like, what does the next decade look like for alternatives?
I think you're going to see more requirement on us all as fund managers, those that are fund managers now, being required to actually place the capital. Because there's so much dry powder right now. We're talking to LPs and they're like, well, we're not going to make another commitment because we've already made commitments and they're not calling the capital, but they have to reserve that capital. So I think that there's going to be a lot more in the LPA agreements with your LPs that say, if you don't deploy it over this 3 or 4 year period, like you say you're going to, we have the right to pull it back. So we're already seeing some investors say, you need to deploy this because we met with one family office. We have $1 billion committed, $450 million of uncalled capital after 10 years. So they're sequestering that capital, making nothing on it, probably money market rates, right? But they have to have it there for when they get called, and it's not being called. So I think that's what's going to change in alts for sure. So it puts the pressure on us as fund managers to get it out.
I was going to say, I think what we're seeing right now within this landscape is the ability to source deals, to go through the due diligence on those deals that you're looking at. The speed of those is going to pick up, and it is picking up because there is dry powder available. These funds do want to make deals done. They want to get them, you know, into the house as portfolio companies. And I think the technology behind the scenes, now that we have, it's able to help us source the deals quicker. So the technology is going to help us source those deals a lot faster. It's going to help us do the due diligence faster, and hopefully gets us to that end of the transaction where we actually close quicker. And I think from an adaptability, everyone's going to have access to that. It's just a matter of how they implement it and how quickly they implement that data scrub, and then actually analyzing it and getting those deals done.
So, love it. Dan, question for you. As we start to talk about data, right, there's an abundance of data out there today. And we're starting to see this shift in you know, Aren't a GP Stakes Fund. I'm underwriting managers all the time. There's more often than not, there's a lot more systematic investment strategies, right? Where people, I mean, it's black and white. We'll invest under X, Y, and Z conditions. We won't under ABC. Less discretionary investing overall. With Ugly Unicorn, like, how does systematic investing play? What are you seeing there?
So with crypto, we look at it as software. And you guys are familiar with Bitcoin and maybe Ethereum and some of the other ecosystems like Solana and these other ecosystems. So what we search for is a few things. With these ecosystems, we look for how many software projects are being developed under, it's like a programming language, let's say Ethereum, right? And that gives us an idea of projects and companies and different things that are, like, in a sense, being incubated right now, ready to hatch, right? And so this brings me back to the early 90s when I first got into tech. Right now, when it comes to capital deployment, we can instantly deploy because there are so many great things. It's just, and a lot of people haven't discovered this yet. A lot of people will buy crypto based on, you know, dog on coin, frog on coin type of thing. But we look for three big things. One, a team that's docs, so we know who they are, and they have a historical win track record. So they're not anonymous guys out of some strange European country that, you know, you don't know they could reg your money.
Well, let me ask you, yeah. Can team underwriting, can that be systematic or is that all discretionary? Is it subjective or is it definitive in how you underwrite people?
You know, right now, again, it is still the Wild West. And so, again, you have to check out who the jockeys are, the roadmap, and make sure it's not just a cut and paste white paper. And one thing we look for is functional utility. Does the project actually benefit supply chain tracking, for example? That's one. Oil and gas tracking, all these kind of things. There was one project that saved Walmart like $170 million the first 3 months just because it's good software. So that's it's a really tough one right now, yeah. Though, because there's so many popping up, and sometimes it's just a small group of guys, and it doesn't really have a lot of functional utility, but we see it being able to be plugged in example with our AI blockchain deployments right now.
Gotcha.
But I think it is subjective. You said, is it more subjective? Well, hell yes, unless you have a PhD in all things Star Trek. I don't think you understand what the hell's going on out there. Honestly, sorry, Dan, but not everybody's as smart as you. And so how do you invest systematically in that? I don't think it's possible yet. I think it's still the early state. It's the 90s, right?
Yes.
Chloe, do you agree? Is investing systematic? Can you, talk to me about it.
Yeah. So in the hotel world, there's a ton of data. That's one thing that we like about it. You can draw data from every brand, right? Marriott, Hilton, IHG, they all have this massive amount of data and they'll share it. I think there are parts of the data analysis that are absolutely systematic. So for example, Marriott got savvy to the fact that instead of taking a bet on going into a market that was unproven for hospitality, what they were gonna do is they're gonna look at data for other hotels that are in the area. Take a Holiday Inn Express, which is IHG, take a Hampton Inn, which is Hilton, take a Hilton Garden Inn, which is also Hilton. And they're gonna find areas, hotspots in the country where those hotels were doing well, had high average daily rate, high occupancy, high revenue, all those kinds of things, but did not have a Marriott presence there. So they weren't capturing all of that corporate Marriott Bonvoy. They said, we're gonna put together this algorithm that goes through and searches through all that data, finds these hotspots where Marriott is not in, and then we're gonna put a Marriott flag there. And this is super systematic, right? There's not someone going through looking at pages of data. And we've been a part of that. We've done 7 hotels now in those areas. We put a Marriott there, and immediately what happens, you gobble up 75% of the market share, like literally overnight. And so I think there are places where you can do systematic, but to Andrew's point, everything is discretion. Everything is subjective, right? You have to look at land and how the oil works and how the low, there's so many things that we're not yet at the point where you can turn on a switch and something can invest for you, at least in something as opaque as real estate.
Bryce?
I was gonna say, we're very quantitative based in how we look at data and how we decide what the investment decisions are. We suck down about $1.5 million worth of data every year just to feed into our machines, which makes systematic investing for us fairly simple. Yet there's even with all that data telling us a lot of things, it still becomes a qualitative process at the end, in the sense that we have to really understand, it said that we needed to do A, B, and C, but we need to understand what A, B, and C really are before we pull that trigger. So systematic to a point where you have to have some qualitative overlay.
I was just gonna add one thing to that. So with us, we build about $100 million of real estate every year on the year. And when you make that much of a bet, you can look through all of the, especially in your arena, you can make all of the data decisions you want. And we use AI, we use a technology called Placer AI, which a lot of people use in real estate right now. You get all the data and it says, if you go here, this is what you're gonna make. And you're like, well, how the hell does it know that? And then you go and you build it. And then when that doesn't happen, there's nobody to blame in the AI world for that being wrong, right? So what do you still do? You still look at the data and you still go and stand there. And then it's very much so quantitative and qualitative. It's not just quantitative. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I think the scary part though is when fund managers mix up the two. They try to get systematic about things that have to be subjective, or they try to get subjective about things that really are systematic. And that's when it gets scary. And fund managers, I think, make mistakes.
Yeah. Well, let's double click into this. So, I mean, how, obviously artificial intelligence just starts with good data, right? Good machine learning starts with good data. So you mentioned a couple softwares. I would love to, I think it's a very important topic. How are you guys, actively integrating artificial intelligence into your investment strategies? And what do you plan on doing and hope doing in the coming years?
We're using it on consumer trends. Interestingly enough, we can go and scrape the internet to say, what is the trend right now for Asian cuisines? That's in our world. And it'll actually grab all of the reviews and the feelings of what people feel, their sentiments towards that sector. Is it going up? Is it going down? Is it flat? So we use that to say, should we be looking for brands in that segment? And that's very much so an AI-based quant system that we use. It would take you years to pull that data together. And that absolutely directs our investment team to focus on that segment because of that.
As people like Dan build better computers for us to process things, it allows us internally to take this data and actually extrapolate data that we're looking for, and also with the help of our tech group, understand things that we're not looking for.
So Bryce, when you're talking about this data, is it people? Like, are you hiring data scientists, on your team, or is this you know, softwares that you're implementing, or like, you know, where does it, you know, where does the rubber hit the road?
So for us, the rubber hits the road inside of what we call our optimizer, which is sucking down all this data and spitting out the end result for us. So that's 100% quant run. And at the end of the day, it's the actual investment team looking at the underlying output. Is this exactly where we want to go? Oh, maybe there's a red flag, because look, AI is not going to pick up on the fact that the CFO, you know, just quit the board yesterday because they were having an affair with their secretary. That stuff's not going to get picked up right away. Now, AI is getting better, and it'll tell you that. But right now, you still need that kind of human overlay.
There's two things in crypto. We've used AI for trading bots. It's always good to have manual limitations, because it works until there's a black swan event, and then it's broken, and you could just get wiped. And I've seen people make millions and millions, and suddenly it's this thing, and they want to build a whole project around it, and suddenly they're so in the hole red, it's crazy. So it's important to have manual controls still on it, and like, similar to what you guys do. Another thing is looking at volatility and fear, kind of like the VIX in the stock market. You can measure fear in the market. You can measure with AI fear in subsectors. One of the areas that we really like is AI hybridization into blockchain. That's a lot of where we're deploying a lot of our money. And it helps with project analysis, but also confidence. Because a lot of it gets run up because of emotions right now, because there's still not a lot of functional utility on these startup projects. But AI can be a great tool.
Very simply, for us, the way rubber meets the road, we kind of view it as, you know, Tony Stark in the Iron Man suit. Tony Stark's a great guy, super smart, all that, but the Iron Man suit allows him to do so much more, right? So we have our analysts who, you know, we don't have enough to pay for PhDs and all this kind of stuff and just start staffing it up. So we have these analysts that are kind of your typical entry-level analyst, but we give them these AI tools that allow them to do work that they would never be able to do on their own. Things see trends that they would never be able to see. In hotel world, what a lot of that means is labor optimization. It's very, very difficult to guess how many housekeepers need to be staffed on a given hotel on a given night based on walk-in rates and what the group rate is and how often people want to be cleaned. And it's very difficult to just look at an Excel spreadsheet and come up with that. But those are kind of things that we just use. Like, often they're just plugins to our Excel models, and it looks at all of our data, our labor scheduling, and it helps our analyst.
Gotcha. Love it. All right, for our last topic, I want to talk about digitization and tokenization of assets. So right back to you, Kaloa. You know, what are you seeing in, you know, the real estate market in that regard, and how is it, you know, impacting the landscape?
So actually, the company I founded before running this, we basically were tokenizing home equity for homeowners. So we know a lot about this. One of the things that's interesting that we're seeing is you're getting a ton of these liquidity premium that previously had been reserved for public markets being applied to private assets. And that's doing a lot of screwy things. And frankly, there's a lot of unknowns. One of the things it's doing is you are seeing liquidity premium for privately traded, historically illiquid assets. So like the secondaries market for funds, right? You buy into a real estate portion, you have 10% of apartment X. Normally being able to get bought out of that is very difficult, but now you can trade and sell that. You can break into small shares, trade and sell it. If it's hosted on a blockchain, there's all these companies that are doing that. The interesting thing though is, does that create value to the overall enterprise? I think the answer is yes, just like you see in public, companies go public and their value goes up. But does that create intrinsic, so then what happens though when you try to borrow against that value because the cash flow hasn't moved? And so I think there's an interesting scenario where you have valuations go really high for things, but I'm not sure that affects maybe the day-to-day, whether it's a lending and your eventual exit. And so it's interesting seeing that right now. We are seeing the premium liquidity kick in, but I'm not sure I'm seeing that second order and third order effects yet being harvested.
So in blockchain, we believe everything will be tokenized. We listen to Larry Fink and even Jamie Dimon, who sometimes have opposing views, right? BlackRock has already been one of the pioneers for large institutions to start tokenization of assets, but all of them would agree that most equities will be tokenized. That will just be the new platform, just like everything, again, with the internet became e-com, pretty much, right? So that'll be the new standard for efficiency. But also with blockchain, how it's a little bit different, though, is a lot of these ledgers will be public, and some will be private. And so a lot of people like that transparency. And the government sure likes it, and Bridger and I are actually pro-compliance, because we believe that means mass adoption. And one big key factor a lot of people didn't see is the CHIPS Act. I just retired from Intel's board advisor after 16 years, and they received a little over $11 billion in the first tranche, another $5 billion. And this is like PPP money to build chip manufacturing factories. So, but what you're going to see, though, is if you look at the size of the land and the allocation, the government doesn't give free money. At least my theory is, it's just my theory, and Bridger's theory, too. We believe that the central bank digital dollar will be processed in a lot of these subsidized hardened security sites for manufacturing. And the idea of why the government, so you guys know, want to bring manufacturing here is if China invades Taiwan or something, we don't have this massive chip shortage. So they're earmarking another $250 billion for this infrastructure, which will be the backbone of tokenization.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, so you mentioned BlackRock just did their own tokenization fund where they work with an outside group to, you know, allow people to buy their money market essentially on Ethereum, on the blockchain, which is really the way I think we're going to see equities, the equity markets, fixed income markets. They have to go this way. Because right now we're still in a world of what we call T+2 when it comes to trading equities, which is crazy if you think about it. If I make a trade right now, I'm not going to get the stock in my account until Monday after the close. So what happens to my cash? Right now the custodians are sitting on it and they're collecting the VIG, right? They're collecting the interest off my cash. The blockchain's going to eliminate all that. It's going to make that transaction immediate, where if I buy or sell something, it's recorded, it's done. There's no intermediaries, there's nothing that has to be done within that area. And I can only imagine what it's gonna do in the world of, like, say, title insurance. I mean, what a stupid thing, really. You know, in the real estate world, I'm not gonna jump into that, but I think title insurance is ridiculous. Why don't you just tokenize that? And then you know exactly what happened. You can scrub every database to understand exactly if there's something against something. So tokenization is definitely gonna happen, and it's gonna improve the efficiencies of any market that gets involved with it.
I think looking forward, though, like, where is the value lie? Let's say things are going to be tokenized. You still don't have to have market creators for that token, right? No one cares if there's a token that no one knows about, and, you know, doesn't have. You have to create liquidity by creating buyers and sellers. I think it's actually one of the things that those attending this conference should be very mindful of, because it used to be the case that if you knew how to, if you're a Wall Street guy, whatever that, then you could then go raise money and you knew everything else. There is this breakdown of kind of roles where now you have folks who are just have the ability to attract eyeballs, which are the new currency, and they then are then able to raise money off of that ability to attract eyeballs. It's why you have the Steph Curry fund. It's why you have the Venus and, you know, Serena Williams fund. It's why you have all these kind of funds. And so it's interesting that, like, especially in the Black Card, and I'm a member of Black Card, that you learn how to help maybe those who have that ability but don't have the know-how, right? And so I think as tokenization happens, there's a greater need, a greater hunger to create eyeballs on your token or on your asset or on your marketplace. And so those who know how to operate within that regulatory framework and within the finance framework have massive advantages.
Interesting. All right, we're just almost out of time here. Awesome discussion. Look, we've got a room full of emerging managers. Before we close, I'd like each of you just to, I mean, what advice do you have for somebody who's getting into this game, just starting out early on? Andrew, let's start with you. I mean, keep it a minute or two, but what advice do you have for the room here?
Yeah, the advice I'd have right now, I'm raising a fund right now. We're raising our third fund, $250 million. We've raised $135 million in the last 2.5 months. The only reason that we've been able to raise that money is because LPs right now are looking for a few things. They're looking for niche managers. And when they say niche managers, they're saying, well, I want to invest into him because he understands how to go buy hotels. I invested into a Marriott-based fund that is investing into other Marriott hotels. That's because they're niche managers. I'm a niche manager, and I'm an expert at what I'm doing, and that's why they want to give you money. So I think that the future is going to be more, instead of generalists, and I think you said it earlier too, Lincoln, and I was like, that's exactly what you should be saying to everybody here looking to do a fund, is be niche, be an expert. And the next thing is, go get the alpha. Once you invest into it, don't just spray and pray that that's going to be a good return for your investors, and go raise more money and live on the fees. Put your money with them. This is my advice. You said advice, right? I'd say put your money with them and ride it with them and go get the alpha. Get the return, and when you get the return for them, when you go back to the well, that well is going to be full for you.
Thank you. Bryce?
Yeah, that's good. You know, my advice, having started out raising funds in 2010, it's when we launched our first fund. What was key for us then, and it's still today, is over-communicate with your LPs that you're targeting. Over-communicate with everything that you're doing. Let them know about deals that you did, deals you didn't do, why you didn't do them, why you looked at it, how it turned out, the ones that you do. It's so important to over-communicate. And I'm talking about the LPs that aren't LPs yet. You know, these are your prospective LPs. but never let them kind of wander what's happening, and look for ways that you can get your name in distribution networks. There's all sorts of things happening behind the scenes, you know, places like Alts Marketplace. You know, you can go and list your fund there, get on different platforms. All the major custodians of Goldman Sachs, the Fidelities, the Schwabs of the world, all have ways for you to actually list your fund on their custodial platforms. Don't be afraid to do that. If you've done everything right and you have the compliance and you have the fund structure in place, there's ways to get your name out there. And so I would just say, get your name out there and over-communicate.
Love it. Dan?
I think what Andrew talked about with the niche is a very important thing, to be the best in your field. I wasn't going to start a fund, but Bridger, I felt like, was the best compliance guy that I knew, him and his dad. Is he out there? John Pennington, both very good at that. And Bridger agreed that as far as crypto, I was the guy who knew how that functioned well. I think that's highly critical. But I think the most important thing for all fund managers out there, no matter what type of fund you have, is managing expectations and building a community with your LPs. And so all our LPs, a lot of them have become great friends, and the side deal flow and the JV deals they've done together far outpace the amount of money we even manage for the fund. And so it's almost like building a community of good friends that can help each other. And managing expectations is important. And one thing we like to do is Bridger and I will do an investor call, and we tell people, you're going to see these bumps in the road most likely because historically this has happened. Expect this. So if they know that crypto is probably going to take a 30% correction up to the halving and after, they're not trying to pull all their money and freak out because they know, okay, this is normal, and we have the charts to back that. So you send the data to everybody.
Love it. Thank you.
Just very shortly, I think it's a danger to skip over learning how to be an operator or finding an operator for your fund and skip right over to capital allocation. So it's very, very easy to raise money when you know how to operate in the investment class that you're doing. I was raising hotels. I was young when we started raising. We bought $650 million of hotels mainly in the last 3 years. I grew up in hotels since the time I was 4 years old. I knew hotels. So I think finding an operator, whether it's yourself, it doesn't have to be yourself, right? You can find an operator, but too many people are raising money, trying to raise funds, whatever, and they don't understand how to operate the class, whether it's restaurants, whether it's crypto or whatever else. And so you can do all the other things perfectly, but I think if you can't operate, find that operator, then it's not gonna go well.
Thank you. Can you help me in thanking this wonderful panel for their expertise today? I mean, phenomenal. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Thank you for coming out. Wonderful time. Thank you.
All information shared are solely the thoughts and opinions of the author or guests. Content is for educational purposes only. Do not take any information from the show as financial, investment, tax, or legal advice. Seek counsel from a licensed professional before taking action in any business pursuit. We're not selling or soliciting a security in any way, shape, or form. The host may maintain positions in securities discussed on this podcast. Guests on the show may be current or historical clients of Fund Launch, Fund Launch Partners, or Black Card Capital Partners.